When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
Hello, I'm Craig Parkinson, and this is the Two Shot Podcast. Pop the kettle on, and let's dive in. How the devil are you? Now, just before you start opening that advent calendar, because yes, it is the 1st of December 2022 today, I want to talk to you about a few things. I want to say thank you, first of all, for the response, the phenomenal response to Julie Hesmondholz's episode last week. A lot of you are rushing out to get a book, which is brilliant. I finished it and, yeah, you're going to thank me. And it's always a pleasure to have Julie on the show. She's always got something important to say. And plus, she's just bloody lovely, isn't she? So, fantastic episode. Speaking of that, we've got another absolute belter for you this week. I'm so happy that we managed to sit down with Liz White. We have been trying to get dates organised for quite some time, me and Liz, but what with one thing and another, it has been difficult. But this week we made it happen and we sat down and we discussed lots of things. Now, you're going to know Liz from so many things. She's such a brilliant actor. I suppose most famously for her role opposite past TSP guest John Sim in The Exceptional Life on Mars on BBC. But this being the Two Shot Podcast, we don't discuss that. We discuss more important things like what's best to do on a Sunday and if you should leave the theatre at the interval, the pros, the cons, the whys, the why nots. Let's get down to it. This is the Two Shot Podcast with the incredible Liz White. Get your Baileys in hand. Here we go. Maybe it's a bit too early for that. It wasn't when we recorded. Liz White, how are you?
Oh, I'm good, thanks, Craig. How are you doing?
I'm good. Well, it's kind of funny, even though I don't talk about jobs when I talk to actors on this podcast, but I'm in my final week of filming with our friend John Sim, and now I come off set and I come and talk to you, and there's a lovely connection there. But we won't talk about that. That's not what we do, because we talk about the people. But before we start, I want to do something that I haven't done for a while. And it's just a few random questions that you answer in your own way.
Okay.
Because you'll get the gist. That's a huge... Just to let you know, Liz White is picking up the biggest mug of tea or coffee I've ever seen in my life.
Because it's out of perspective. It's closer to the camera, though. There you go.
That's. I feel like a borrower right now. That's ridiculous. Elizabeth White, a good film or a good book?
A good film. I can give you both. I saw The Wonder the other day on Netflix and absolutely had me pinned to the sofa.
Well, that was one of ours the other night that we were too tired to watch. But yeah, it's definitely on the list.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's beautiful to watch. And Florence Pugh is a bit of a wonder anyway, isn't she? I know.
I believe the genius that Tom Burke is in brilliant. That as well.
It's all brilliant. And Niamh Algar and Elaine Cassidy. They're all great. and it looks beautiful. And then this very, very still performance by this 13-year-old kid who's Elaine Cassidy's daughter in real life.
No way.
Yeah, so they get to play mother and daughter on screen. And I read a lovely interview with Elaine Cassidy and her daughter talking about it. And she said, Elaine Cassidy said, there's so much talent on set. I would have just swept the floors there. But as it was, I got this great part to be the mum. And they were looking for the girl for ages and ages, sifting through tapes. And then, you know, it's similar to Florence Pugh's story about how she got in. It was a last-minute self-tape. They just thought, oh, we'll knock it out. The director's been looking for months, thinking, if we don't find the right girl, we won't make this film. And then he comes upon her tape and just goes, right, that's it, we've got the film, it's her. And there they have, the wonder. But it's great. And films like that, they can look quite austere, you know. It's set in, like, this massive landscape in Ireland somewhere, and you're not really sure if there's going to be any fun in it or, you know, any entertainment, but there sure is. Like, it's just hugely stimulating.
Well, that's one for the list. So we're going with a good film present, Liz yes. White. So my next quick fire question is Saturday night or Sunday yeah. morning?
Oh, Sunday morning, but it's a close one. It's a close one.
Do you think if I asked that question to you 20 years ago, it would be a very different answer?
I think if you asked me that question 24 hours ago, when I was approaching Saturday night, I would have gone Saturday night. But then Sunday mornings are always a little bit rough. You know what I mean? You've got to get up dead early with the kids, kind of regret that extra glass of wine the night before. But then as the day eases in, I love a Sunday now. I love to shut the doors and kind of... And now the nights are drawing in and it's getting chilly and just thinking, you know, we don't have to go anywhere. The week is all about obligations, and Sunday I just think is about, if you can,
get hibernation.
Obligations and hibernate. Oh. Cook.
Completely.
Eat. Yeah.
So throwing the answer away, what about city shopping... Or country stroll?
Oh, country stroll. Because I never get to do it, to be fair. So if I did, I probably would be like, oh, craving the shops. But actually, I do love a country stroll. The closest we've got is a really big park that's about a 10-minute drive from our house.
I'm right in saying that you are... I'm in Brighton right now, but you're in London.
I'm in South East London.
South East.
So... The park that I'm thinking of is like the South East London version of Hampstead Heath. It's not quite as big, but you can get lost in it if you haven't been there often enough and lost your bearings. And it's got, like, you know, you're in different kind of, one minute it's sprawling fields and then the next minute it's deep woodland and then there's a big pond again. Not quite on the scale of Hampstead Heath, but there's a big mansion there. And anyway, it's lovely. That's like the nearest thing I get to a country stroll.
And do you get there a lot? Do you get there with the kids?
I get there with the kids and I don't get there as much as I would like to, and I don't get to the country as much. I'm like really frustrated about that because again it's like an hour and a half drive if you want to get into the country from where I am, or if you want to get to the sea. We manage to do it, I'd say, once every couple of months. But the reality is, like, the weekend's just... And that's it.
Yeah.
But then my mum lives in France. Also, sorry, go on.
No, go on. You carry on.
My mum lives in France, so that's country town. Like, she lives in the middle of nowhere. So when we go and see her, get to... That's it. That's all there is. There is...
Where is she? North, south?
She's very central, near Limoges. She's about an hour east of Limoges, so I know it's very... I mean, Limoges itself is very beautiful, but again, don't get that much. But where she is, there's literally her house, and then there's a fella that owns some kennels who lives down the road, and then that's it. And then out the back of her... her house is... There's wild boar, there's deer. I mean, you have to have your eyes peeled and be lucky, but they're there.
Wow.
And, it's lovely. And, you know, I just kind of shut down when I get out there, but I just want to sleep all the time.
Well, sometimes that's important, just to shut down and sleep all the time. I mean, I'm going away. I finished filming on Friday, and luckily I've been allowed to fly away on Saturday to meet my girlfriend, and we're going to have a week's holiday for the first time that we've had this year. And I know it's going to take me like a good couple of days to not be on,
yeah,
just to shut down. But it does take a bit of time, doesn't it?
Yeah. Are you Britain's busiest actor at the moment, Craig Parkinson? Because we have been trying to do this for a while. It's like, oh, sorry, Liz, can't do this. I'm filming again.
I know.
Another project.
You know what my life's been like for the past few years, Liz? It's been slightly hectic, to say the least.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm driving back and forth all the time and picking up my son and trying to spend time with him. But I was dropping him back with his mum yesterday. So I was back in Manchester this weekend for the first time in quite a while. And we had a brilliant weekend, and I was dropping him back with his mum on Sunday because I knew that I had to come back to Brighton to film this morning, and obviously he's got school. And it took 8 hours in the car from my house in the centre of Manchester, dropping him back and then getting back here because we were stuck on the M5. Being stuck on the M5 for like 4.5 hours with an 11-year-old boy, it's not fun at all.
Was he on his technology?
Kind of not, because we've got into these. So we started reading Stephen King. Very into horror and the paranormal. And we've started listening as father and son. We've got into it, and we don't do any episodes without each other. You know that, like, if you're with
lovely
partner, you go, commitment. No, don't watch that. No, commitment. So we've started listening to Danny Robbins' podcasts on BBC Sounds, and he's got things like the one that we're on at the moment is The Witch Farm, which is about this Welsh farm, and just the most awful things happen. And the way it's structured, it mixes actors dramatizing certain scenes from it, and then real life experts and skeptics and people text in and email, and it's really interesting. It's great for drives. I highly recommend it. So that's something that we share on drives instead of him being on his technology, because you know what it's like with children on. I mean, you're a mother, and it's of a certain
age, we're not quite at that stage yet. We're lucky, but we've decided to drive to France this Christmas, and I'm nervous because that's going to be like 9 hours. So I think we're going to have to resort to some sort of iPadula. But I haven't got one. And again, it'd be the sort of thing the night before we'd be like, "Did you buy one? Did you get one? Have you got an iPad?" "No, I thought you were getting it."
Did you download that stuff? Why have you downloaded it?
That's the conversation we'll be having at 5 o'clock on Tuesday morning before Christmas.
preparation with driving with kids, because you just don't know what's going to happen. Speaking of that, Sunday breakfast or Sunday lunch?
Oh, Sunday lunch, definitely. Breakfast for me every day is the same. It's just a piece of toast with marmalade. That's my breakfast.
Is it? Lunch, has it always been like that, Lil?
No, I mean, I used to have two slices, so one would be Marmite and one would be marmalade. I'm cutting down.
It's a fucking great combination, Liz.
And then, you know, I went through a brief period of perhaps having a boiled egg, but it's just too much. So now I just have me a toast and marmalade, and then cook a Sunday lunch. That's what I do.
Liz White, walk out at the interval or sit it through?
Sit it through.
Always.
Always.
I had this conversation at work. It came up today, and I'm pretty sure I've said this once or twice over the last 5 years of this podcast. I have walked out.
I
don't mind admitting that I have. And
How much theatre do you do, though? As a performer, how much do you do?
No, I don't do a lot of theatre.
Well, but then I'll put it to you. Go on.
No, but I do go and support my friends. And I'm not saying I walk out of my friends' stuff, because generally I don't. It's other stuff that I walk out of that I just go, no, I'm not going to invest in any more time of this. I can't do it. I very rarely walk out of my friends' performances.
That would be really awkward as well, because you'd have to...
Well, that'd be terrible. I couldn't do it. But you were going to say, go on.
Well, I was going to say that I think my tolerance for things has got less over the years that I've survived this earth. So I used to be like, I would always finish a book, but now I just don't. If I'm not in by page 60 at the latest, I'm like, no, I can't do it anymore. Life's too short, move on. Mm-hmm. But I suppose with plays, I don't get to go to the theatre often enough, I think, now to test that theory. So I don't know if my tolerance is any weak, but now if I go, I just think I've got to kind of savour this. And also sometimes if it's really shit, it's just as informative as if it's really good.
Yeah,
but you learn something. As a performer, like, I think if you weren't in this business, then if you needed to walk out, then fair enough. I did once do a play where I had to do quite an explicit sex scene on stage.
Which one was that?
It was called References to Salvador Dali Make Me Hot, and it was a play that I did with Rasheem McBreen, who I'm going to work with again next year. And we did it at the Arcola. And about a week into the run, we started... It was like Pavlov's dog, because you just knew as soon as this scene started, the seats would start to flip up and they'd be shuffling. And then when the lights came, like, lifted back up, there'd be significantly less people in the audience. But I really try and stick it through.
It's a funny one. I mean, I do try and stick it through. I understand what you're saying about... that we learn from seeing things. But I think 9 times out of 10, if I'm not getting it by the first half, there's nothing that it's going to do by the second half for me sticking around.
No. Often it gets worse, doesn't it, the second half?
I think so.
I think it does,
you know.
But, you know, my fella's not an actor, and I've taken him to see some shows.
No, he's not.
And, and he's left. And I find it so offensive. Not only because I've bought the tickets and he's left. But obviously, mainly, that's my problem. But also, just like, how can you do that? Like, and they'll be for really namby-pamby reasons. We went to see Inheritance, which I was completely enthralled by, and... He left because...
What was Inheritance?
It was a play in two... So it was two parts. Yeah, I saw part one one night, part two on another night, but both parts were like three acts long. And it was about the AIDS crisis, really. But it was brilliant. It was beautifully directed. Stephen Dodge.
It was epic.
It. Amazing.
Yeah.
It was epic, yeah. And so you had to kind of strap in. And Pete, before he'd even got the seatbelt to the clicker point, he was just like, do you know what? No, my back hurts. I'm going.
I mean, you're telling me this, and like, I'm not surprised. I know Pete a little bit. So,
but he missed out so much. But, you know, I don't know if he'd do that like, now.
No, but it's like, you know, when... Angels in America was on a few years ago at the National. You know, strap in.
Yeah.
It's an epic tale that you need to sit down and watch and get involved with. But we were at the theatre on a Sunday about 4 weeks ago, 4 or 5 weeks ago, to see The Doctor with Judith Stevenson.
Yeah.
It was absolutely incredible. And it was a bit of a do thing for a Sunday afternoon. And we'd had a lovely morning, we had a Sunday off, so we went to the Royal Academy, we had a bit of lunch, and then we were going to see Juliet in her play. And there was two quite well-known figures in front of us on, like, the fourth row or something. And it's the Duke of York's. It's not a big space.
Was it Richard and Judy?
It wasn't Richard and Judy. I would have called them out if it was. But they left at half time, and I just thought they had a responsibility actually to stay because there was rumblings that they were there, and like people knew that were there, and then there was two gaping seats right in front of me. So that on that occasion, it's not on. That's not
I don't think that's fair, Craig. I don't think that's fair. So you can walk out, but people are more famous than you can't. I think you've got to make a bit more of a decision about this and decide whether it's right or not.
Yeah, like, that's exactly... No,
because
what
when you become mega famous, you won't want to lose that right, will you?
Do you know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying is sit at the back. Yeah. Never sit in the first 4 rows if you're going to walk out because people are going to see you and that's exactly. not on. Always take a back seat.
If they were that famous, they probably got house seats, didn't they? They didn't even pay for them. That's probably why.
Oh, yeah, I think they did, but still, you know. And the thing is, it was a fucking great play. It was heavy, but don't.
I've seen some great plays this week.
Hit me up with some great plays, Liz White.
I saw Best of Enemies this week. Incredible. It started at the Young Vic and now it's at the Noel Coward Theatre. It's about the meeting of Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley in America. Two massive intellectuals. They had a series together on ABC to get ABC's ratings up at the time of a massive election in America at the end of the Vietnam War. So it was like... It was massive, but the performance of David Harewood and Zachary Quinto and the rest of the cast, amazing. And I saw The Band's Visit at the Donmar. Have you seen that? Can you hear me? No? It's about a group of musicians from Alexandria in Egypt that are going to Israel to perform a concert, but they end up in the wrong town. They end up in a really quiet town instead of this place that's the capital of culture. So they end up in this really sleepy town for a night, kind of lost musicians, and it's about what happens in that 24 hours, meeting the locals and turn of events. But it's all live music on stage, so you've got these incredible musicians playing these incredible instruments that I've never heard played live before. I think there was 12 musicians and singers. It's just such a joyful, wonderful piece. So, but I don't know how long it's left.
We were talking about musicals today at work because managed to tell everybody that our friend Danny Mays is doing Guys and Dolls next year at the Bridge Theatre, which I know we're all like absolutely buzzing about. And we were thinking those big old school musicals don't get staged much anymore. You don't see Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. It's been a long time since Carousel. But then Arthur Darvill starred in Oklahoma last year, which is coming back next year. And we managed to see it at the Young Vic. And it was extraordinary.
Yeah.
Because you just realised a lot of these characters are absolutely abhorrent. I mean, they're quite awful human beings. There's not a shred of sort of likability about them at all. But that staging of Oklahoma was incredible. So that's two musicals coming back next year. So that's nice.
Nice. I don't know Oklahoma. I've never seen it. Never seen the film or a production of it. I'd love to see that. I've heard great things. But most of the time when I do see musicals, I'm quite blown away by them, particularly because I'm not a musical theatre performer. I could hold a tune if forced to at a pub piano, you know, but to sing like that in front of an audience, I just couldn't do so. I find it so potent, particularly when it's combined with dance. We took my dad to see Anything Goes, and it was on years ago for his 60th birthday, and we sat, I knew the assistant directors, who got seats at the front of the circle, so we're right there looking into the audience, and there's all those formation dancers. And at the end of the first half, they finish with massive Anything Goes. And my dad just turned to me with tears running down his face and going, "Isn't it brilliant? Right, yes!" It was such a beautiful moment. I had a bit of a snobbery about musicals once I went to drama school, because I went to Lippa, which is quite a predominantly musical theatre place. And
why did you end up at Lippa? Yeah,
it was the only place I got in, and I got in on somebody had dropped out, basically. So I was on a waiting list. So when my audition came, you had to do a song, a piece you'd written, and a classical piece. So I did the piece that I'd written and was dead proud of it. That went really well. Did my classical piece. That was all right. Then I thought, this is going well. Then I had to do my song. And I'd chosen Ain't Misbehaving. But I'd also not chosen the key. So I'd given the pianist the music, and then just started off on completely the wrong note. And they were kind enough to give us a tall stool to sit on to like anchor ourselves. And I just remember, I had my eyes shut, my legs swinging, and my hands gripping onto the side of this stool, kind of praying that it would be over and they wouldn't notice how bad I was. But anyway, they did, because I didn't actually get a place, and then somebody dropped out and they said, "Well, you need a second skill. What is it?" And I was really into photography, and because I hadn't got in anywhere, I was prepared. I'd got an offer from Edinburgh Napier to do photography, thinking I'll do photography and then in my holidays I'll join the Fringe or whatever. I had really no idea. So photography was my second skill. And I set up my own little dark room at Lippa, and I went and I took pictures. I wasn't a brilliant photographer, and also I found it really difficult to be in it as an actor and out of it as a photographer, being the observer. So I had to, after like the first year and a half, I stopped taking pictures. But by then they'd kind of forgotten that was my second skill, and they didn't bother. No one ever marked me on it anyway. It was way back when. Photography.
You picked it back up, Liz, yeah?
Not really, because, I've always done a bit, and obviously with an iPhone, you've got the opportunity to take great pictures. You've got no excuse not to take a great picture. And I'm never really that overwhelmed with what I take, you know? So I just don't think I've got... I love it and I appreciate it, and I'd love to think I had the eye, but my fella's much better at taking pictures than I am. So, I didn't pick it back up. But I did do it for a good solid, 4 years, really. I wanted to be a photographer for a while.
But in your heart of hearts...
In my heart of hearts, I wanted to be an actor.
You wanted to be an actor.
Yeah.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
So let's talk about Lippa. How was that 3 year journey?
It was quite horrifying at the beginning, because everyone was singing all the time. I mean, I never heard anything like it. Everyone knew all the words to Rent, never heard of it, and other musicals, never heard of them. It was in the bar, it was in the toilets, downstairs. You just hear all these choruses of voices singing, and I was just like, I've got no idea what you're on about or why.
It's quite intimidating, isn't it?
Yeah, God, yeah. And... So I just felt a bit lost, really. But it kind of didn't bother me, because I'd done youth theatre. That's how I got into it. I didn't really do acting at school. So I'd already done a bit of performing, and I'd taken 2 years out, and I really knew that acting was what I wanted to do. And I knew that I didn't just want to be famous, because when I was a kid, I ended up being a presenter for a local TV programme. And I was awful at that as well. But the beauty of that was that I was like, yeah, I can't be me on screen. This is hideous, and I'm not very good at it. But at least that tells me that I'm not just doing this because I want to be on camera. I'm doing it because it's the acting that I want. So I carved my own little niche when I went to Lipa. And I think the dark room in the utility room at the college was kind of my getaway, and that's where I would go. And it was handy to keep me on the outside for a bit for the first year while I kind of softly integrated. But then most of my mates were a couple of years above. I ended up living with a girl in Liverpool who didn't even go to our college. And I never did the digs thing. And then when it came to the final year, Lipper had only been going 4 years, and they kind of quickly ran out of money.
Yeah, I remember.
And like when we started, you used to have 24-hour access to the building. So, of course, in my head, I was like, this is brilliant. I'm just going to rock up at 3 a.m. and do a rehearsal, as if you ever would. Like, you don't need 24-hour access at drama school. But
it's not a PL gym.
Exactly. We all like kicked up a bit of a stink at the time, as if we need 24-hour access. Anyway, and also then for our final projects, they couldn't get an external director to come in and direct. Whereas in the years below, we'd had some, like, you know, people that had a reputation that would look good on a CV. When it came to our third year final project, we didn't have anybody, and nobody in my year at that time really expressed an interest in directing. So I was like, right, I'm going to do my own show. So I did a one-woman show, and there was a girl in the year below me who I'd always just kind of... I just thought she was spectacular, and I approached her one day with a script and said, I've got a feeling that you'd be a really good director. And she was like, well, funnily enough, I've just been talking about that. I said, well, okay, will you read this script? And then I had another friend who directed me the year below, who worked at Hull University. And so they ended up co-directing it. Anyway, long story short, we did it at the local theatre after the school saying they wouldn't give us a room and they wouldn't give us a rehearsal space. And we did the local theatre and the Unity Theatre. And then we got into the National Student Drama Festival and, like, won the festival, and then got this amazing agent who I've been with ever since. And it really, like, kick-started my career. But it was all because of adversity. It was all because they said they weren't going to have this external director, they wouldn't support us. It's like it pushed us to aim higher, really.
And to take matters into your own hands.
Yeah, to take matters into our own hands and to take risks and to ask favours. Like, you know, I mean, there was a lad in the year below who was really good at web design, and he was kind enough to design our posters. And my friend knew somebody who was an amazing artist, and she did this amazing poster for it. So, you know, asking people to get involved. And that was the other brilliant thing about Lipper, was that there were people of all disciplines that went there. So there were costume designers, stage managers, lighting designers. So you could recruit people from other disciplines, and
yeah,
they would get on board. And Liverpool's just such a fantastic city. Like, to have the Unity space there. And actually they didn't have a night free in their programming, but they said, how long's your show? I was like, well, it's 40 45 minutes 50 minutes. He said, well, if you make it 45, we've got a show comes down at 9, so you can go on at 10 o'clock and do it then. Like, brilliant, that'll do, you know, just like, yeah, wicked. So we did 3 nights and sold out, and that, you know, that was it. It really, that changed my life doing that.
And was there a goal after leaving Lipper? I mean, obviously theatre was at the forefront of your mind, but did you envisage sort of wanting a career on the television or
not
on
at
stage,
all.
Or you it wanted wasn't, to sort of.
I suppose if anything on screen, it was film, because that's what I'd. I didn't really watch. I suppose I'd watched loads of telly, of course I had, but the things that I was really artistically stimulated by were going to the cinema, seeing an amazing film, or watching back catalogue films, and then and theatre, stage. So that was it, really. That's what I wanted. And then, and actually, that's how my agent got me, because when we were at the National Student Drama Festival, I was approached by Pippa Markham's ex-husband, who said,
right.
Michael, who said, I think Pippa would love you, come down and meet her. And she's, by the way, she's Tim Ross' agent. So I was like, oh my God, it's Tim Ross' agent. Yes, yeah, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. So I couldn't wait to set up this meeting with Pippa Markham. And then by the time we got back to Lipa after Scarborough, there was a fax, and they said, oh, someone's been in touch. And it said, we're an agency and we'd love to talk to Liz White about representation. And I thought, oh, bless, it'll be like a local agency. But it was ICM, as which are now independent, massive agency. And it was because the Sunday Times sponsored the National Student Drama Festival. And my agent at the time was like, she'd just setting up her books and really interested and flicking through the culture pages on a Sunday and was like, oh, she looks interesting. And that was it. So I went down to London for my meetings, met Pippa Markham first, who just was the coolest woman. Like, she had these, yes, John Lennon glasses.
She's very cool.
One cycling leg trouser rolled up, you know, she's cycled in, like, her, she was like, well, great, you know, I think you're really interesting, but I'd have to see you in something. And I was like, it's fine, I'll just put something on, I'll make it happen. And then I had my interview at ICM, or Independent, and I was so full of confidence because I thought, I'm going to be with Pippa Markham anyway, it doesn't matter what you say. And I was like,
yeah,
look at my photos, look at this, the reviews, or talk about me, and... And she said, right, I'll offer you representation straight away. And I was like, well, I'll think about it. And I did. And then she rang, because I was like, I want to be with Pippa Markham. And then she rang me back a couple of days later and said, listen, if I can say it, I've got you an audition for a film on Monday, will you come with me? And that was it. I was like, yes, I will. And as it happened, I went down to London. I had 4 auditions on the Monday with me, like, never done it before, A to Z, where am I going, Queen's Park,
yeah,
Abbey Ward, where, you know, wherever. Yeah, and I got one of the jobs. And that was it, that was the start. So it was a skyrocket start for me. It was more than I could have ever imagined. And it's been downhill ever since.
No, it hasn't. It's quite the opposite. But Liz, how old were you at that point when that was happening? 20?
I was 21, I think. 21. I must have been 21 because I'm born late in the year. So even though I'd had a couple of years out, I don't know, I was 21 or 22.
And you were you were still based up north at this point, weren't you?
Yeah, I was still in Liverpool, wanted to be in Liverpool. My flatmate had a baby and I was a godmum, so I wanted to stay up there. And then I just couldn't because of the train fares. I was up and down auditioning all the time. And so I ended up moving. My brother lived in Kent, so I moved in with him for a bit. And
How was that moving down south?
It was a bit alienating, it's not that, I suppose it is young, but when I look at people like Florence Pugh or Saoirse Ronan, big actresses who we've seen kind of grow up on screen, I look at them with complete bafflement and adulation because I just think, how have they managed to, not only their talent, but really their kind of sense of self and their kind of confidence, the choices that they make, they seem really grounded. I mean, obviously, I don't know them personally, but I just think that the way they navigate their career tells me that they've got their head screwed on properly. And
yeah.
I really I didn't have a clue. I think the first initial flurry was brilliant and exciting. And in my first year, I did a couple of plays at the Royal Court with Danny Mays, actually, one of them. And, you know, it was...
I remember.
Dear. And it was like, so it was...
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, so it was, like, amazing. And then when I started to do, I think, more screen telly work, I think that's when I found it a bit... it was just different, you know, signing up for a series. As you know, Craig, it's such a different discipline because a lot of it is about patience and endurance and managing yourself off screen.
And also trust. You know, there's another question on my shortlist that I was figuring out a new shortlist today because I haven't done this for ages. I haven't done like short questions to kickstart an interview. I've been saying this for 5 years now. An interview, it's a conversation. It is an interview, but you know, it's just like a friendly conversation. But it was one of them was less ambition or more ambition.
I think that's
to interpret as you will, but I was talking to one of my best friends a few months ago and we're, you know, I'm 46 now, I know you're younger than me, but he's the same age as me, and we were going, yeah, I mean, I've got less ambition now, I still love it, but I've got the focus, the drive is there, but the focus is different. Mm. So I would say there personally that like the ambition is less. And then you go, well, is that because I've achieved lots of things that I want to do and now my priorities have changed and they're different and I want to support someone who's going through secondary school and, you know, things are changing in my life. And, you know, there's loads of contributing factors. So, I don't know, it's, I suppose it's an open question, less ambition, more ambition.
I think a friend said to me once, and she hit the nail on the head, that in terms of, like, I suppose fame or success, they would, to me, equate with like doing the work that you want to do all the time. That would be my idea of success. And she said, but along with that often comes a bit of fame, you know, and exposure. And she said, you want it, but you don't want it. And that's exactly how I feel. Like actually when I was in Life on Mars, it was probably when I was the most recognisable. And I used to find it really awful, like awful, torturous, being on a Sunday morning and you just want to shut the doors, having to run out to Sainsbury's and you're like there looking at which peanut butter you're going to buy and somebody's like, are you Life on Mars? And, you know, and then the crushing feeling that you've really ruined their day by not being what they expected you to be or, you know, just all those mixed emotions that come with... having a face that people recognise. But now, I certainly go through stages in my career where I feel frustrated and I want to be doing more. But it's always just when I'm out of work, full stop. If I'm working, I'm all right. And it really doesn't, as long as I've taken the job because I like the job, it doesn't really matter whether it's a Channel 5 drama or a, you know, on the stage at the National or whatever, because you're just invested in what you're doing. Because you know, there are some jobs that you don't necessarily, you're not doing it as a labour of love. There are those, but
no. But the thing is, Liz, if we were, I don't know, an electrician or a plumber or a carpet fitter, we would just. We would take jobs that we were invested in because we wanted to do a good job on that carpet, but there's no emotional investment in fitting that carpet, is there? We just want to make that carpet the best it can be for this person and we're taking the money.
Yeah, there is that. But then there's always the surprises that come with it. And it works the other way. But say you might be doing that job where you think, this isn't the finest house that I'm fitting this carpet for. And yet, while I was there, I met this amazing electrician and this amazing plumber. And like, actually, this carpet is buzzing.
because you never know. Because you're always going to learn. You're always going to learn off somebody.
Yeah.
Which is what keeps us going back, I think, personally.
Yeah. I mean, there's never been
one job where I haven't formed some sort of relationship on, and I'm sure it's the same with you.
Mm. There's been a couple of jobs, definitely, if I'm honest, at the time, and most of them when I was younger, because I think I wanted to prioritise different things because, you know, I didn't have a family until I was much older. It was just me for a really long time. So actually I had much more freedom than I gave myself licence for. So I think I took some jobs that, you know, I knew at the time I didn't really want to take them, but I felt I should, or, you know, what if I don't get anything else? And I think it's really good in our game just to be available sometimes. But now I'm older, and like you're saying, I've got commitments and I've got a house and a family, and, you know, I'm much more I'm much more happy to just kind of see what comes next. And unless it's really offensive, then just take it and see what happens, you know? Last year or this year that we're still in, it's actually been pretty quiet for me. I've done a couple of lovely jobs, but had loads of time off. And it's quite an unsettling feeling, really. I want to be working. I love it. So
how do you feel about throwing yourself out into the future and going, I'm going to commit to such and such in 3 months, 4 months' time? Because that's quite a scary thing, because if you're going to say, like, which you are, you're going to be starting a new theatre commitment. That sounds so clinical. A theatre commitment.
You're
doing a play with Roisin McBryn. Amazing.
But that is amazing. So I have no doubts about that. But I have at other times. Like, and also, sometimes you have to make personal choices. I was once, I had a great play on the table and I'd said yes to it and I couldn't wait, but it was like 8 months in the future. And my partner knows all about this, but we hadn't been together that long before. I just thought, I just really want a baby with this guy. I really do. And this is what I want to happen. And I knew if I continued to be signed up to do this play, I couldn't serve the play if I was pregnant. But neither did I know if I was going to get pregnant. I hadn't actually talked about it with my partner because it was still early days. Yeah. So it was all like trying to make decisions. Anyway, I pulled out the play and I got pregnant and that was it. So, you know, and the director was very forgiving in the end. I think at the time they were like, you know, because I couldn't tell them these were my reasons for not taking the play because it was just an idea.
Yeah. And a feeling. That's something that's personal to you. You know, it's heart and it's gut, and two things that you totally have to trust.
Yeah. Thank God I did.
But also,
of course, it would have been all right if I'd signed up for the play and I was pregnant, because they would have worked around it. See, this is not a dilemma that I think a man would have to face. I'm conditioned to think like that at the time. And so I do kind of look back on that with a modicum of regret, because I think, actually, I should have just gone for it, because, you know, I wouldn't have been culpable for making a terrible decision or mistake being pregnant and having this job to go to. But that's what I thought. I thought, everyone would be really pissed off with me if I was pregnant.
But do you think that was your naivety of being younger, or
yeah, but I wasn't that much younger. I think it is the conditioning that we go through as women that I was obviously still subject to. That I just thought, you know, I can frame it two different ways. I can frame it like I did the first time, but actually, like, the following year, I saw Rosalie Craig on stage, 8 months pregnant, in a musical, being hoisted up on almost a trapeze. You know,
that's what I was going to say. You know, was it your naivety, or did you feel it was the industry imposing that onto you and not giving you an avenue to walk down and go, do you know what? Actually, I am pregnant, but I still can fulfil this commitment and play this role.
Yeah,
I suppose, so you've just said it yourself.
The other tricky bit is the person in the play, having a baby was a big thing. It's like she couldn't have a baby. That was part of the... It wasn't Yerma, but it was a play. It was a storyline like that. That was the other reason why I thought, I can't play that part pregnant, because... That actress just cannot be pregnant, because it's a theme of the play that she can't be pregnant. So that was also part of it. So it was the artistic integrity.
But also emotionally, you didn't feel that you could walk that line?
No, I just thought visibly I'd be pregnant.
It all depends on how pregnant. But, and also, you know, we both know the most amazing costume designers in the world. They can figure that shit out.
Yeah, it wasn't my problem, I suppose, looking back on it, but I completely saw it as my problem. I just thought, I can't do this play. Anyway, I pulled out. But it's food for thought, isn't it, actually? What decisions one has made that's the kind of biggest decision, that being a woman has affected the choice that I made.
Do you... Just talking about that specific situation, do you regret it, Liz? Do you regret making that call?
I don't. What I regret is the unease that it caused between me and the director. Only until the point came where I could explain what it was all about. And the fact that I kind of, because I couldn't call it for what it was, I couldn't say it's because I'm thinking I might like to have a baby by this time next year.
Yeah.
So I had to make some fluff up about my career and what I was wanting to do and what direction. Well, it really wasn't about that, but I can imagine they opened that email and thought, God, what a tosser. And of course, you don't...
Do you not think that's sort of... your worry as an actor projecting on what they would think of you?
Yeah, maybe.
I'm only saying that because that's exactly what I would do. I would think the conversations
that go on in the corridors of power, but, you know.
Of course.
You know what I mean? But
yeah,
I don't actually regret it because, hey, I suppose... The point is, at the time, by freeing myself of that commitment, it allowed me to actually pursue having a baby with my partner without any sense of being beholden to something else. I could have that conversation with my partner, and we did decide to have a baby, and we ended up unfortunately getting pregnant, and we've ended up with the person that we've got as our kid, and that's a wonderful thing. So, like, I don't regret it. And work-wise, I went on to do other stuff, and it's fine. It's just interesting, and it's absolutely occurred to me before that my male partner would never have to go, do you know what, I can't go on tour then because I'm having a baby. Because, like, the baby can happen elsewhere from the male, you know. It's only as the person carrying the child that you go, that's what I've got to do.
And do you feel that situations like that you've grown from, that you can just...
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And so... when I wanted another baby, but like work, I just kind of trusted that work would go through. It's so scary having your first child in an industry where you're self-employed. It's not just for actors, anyone where you're self-employed, you don't know what's going to happen. And of course, added to that, an industry that slightly relies on what you look like and what you sound like, you know, all those things that kind of change when you're pregnant and when you have a baby. And I was just so worried that I'd never work again and that I'd completely changed physically. And actually none of that happened anyway. I worked straight away. And I know so many women who are actors who've ended up, just going straight back to work. All those fears completely abated. Fears that you've stacked up against your career, your whole life until that point, thinking, putting it off, it's not the right time, I just need another job first. And of course, sometimes the reality is that's just bare bones money. You just need to make sure you can financially get through a period. Well,
exactly. It's like what we were talking about before, sometimes you've just got to fit that carpet.
Yeah.
And make it the best carpet it can be,
Yeah, yeah. But I suppose that's why the ambition question, I feel much more, on good days, I feel much more relaxed about my path because I just think, it'll fall into place. And it's been falling into place for 20 years so far. Why would it suddenly stop falling into place so dramatically that I'm going to end up in a bed seat in Cornwall?
And maybe sometimes after such... a certain period of time, maybe it's better for us as human beings, and taking the acting out of it, is to relax, and maybe that's going to be better for us, maybe. So Liz, speaking about going back on stage, how long has it been since you were back on the stage?
I did a play in 2019 at Chichester Festival, which was Shadowlands, the lovely story about C.S. Lewis.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was amazing. It really was an amazing trip, that, because, the play was amazing. The director, Rachel Kavanagh, was brilliant. The cast were brilliant, but also...
I love Rachel Kavanagh.
Oh, she's amazing.
She directed me in my second play out of drama school at Regent's Park Open Air Theatre. What an absolutely gorgeous human being.
Yeah, so supportive, lovely. And she managed to make the room feel really... Hugh Bonneville was playing C.S. Lewis, and he was definitely the name for the show, but... And his grace as well, he was just lovely to work with in the room. So you didn't feel any hierarchy, and neither should you, but it was just level playing field for everybody. It was a really lovely time. But also...
As it should be, yeah.
But I also got to go down to Chichester and have 3 nights on my own before I was joined by... my kid, don't have children. It was just so nice. And I remember the first night I went down there, I got a flat really close to the theatre, literally across the car park, and rehearsals obviously started at 10. So, I'm used to working from London, so you've got the commute to add in. So I got up at 7 and I thought, I'm here, I've got no excuse, I'm going to do my yoga. Did a bit of yoga, never done it since, but I did a bit of yoga, had my marmalade on toast. And then I was like, it's only 7:45. I've got 2.25 hours before rehearsals. What do I do? Read the script, I suppose. So, I had that lovely luxury for 3-4 weeks, maybe. It was a lovely, lovely time. But I am nervous about going back on stage. Of course I am. And going to see those plays that I mentioned, like going to see Best of Enemies. Honestly, I met Zachary Quinto after the show because he'd organised this Thanksgiving party for everybody. So we went to this... club, and I went up to him. And he was fantastic, but they were all fantastic. Him and David Hare would kind of lead it though, and they were both phenomenal. So I said, you know, you were brilliant. You were brilliant. And of course, you know, I'm an actor, Zachary, but I did find myself thinking, how has he learned all those lines? And he just looked at me like, get this woman away from me. Get this security. So, but yeah, I was sat there in the audience thinking, shit, I've got to do this next year. What? I'm going to do it.
But you will, and I can't wait to see it. It's you being directed by the incredible Roisin McBryn at the National.
Yeah.
What's the play called, Liz?
It's called Dixon and Daughters. And it's about, it's six women on stage, and it's, there's no interval, so it's, you've got no opportunity to leave.
It's my kind of play, Liz White. I mean, if I wasn't there before, I'm definitely there now, 100%.
That's what my fella said as well. And yeah, it's just proper. It's really, it's one of the best plays I've ever read. And when the morning I first read it, Pete was over the table from me doing his work, and I was on this side just reading, going, making all these involuntary noises. It's a brilliant piece. Can't wait.
Well, Liz, it's been, I'm so pleased we've managed to get this together. I know it's been really difficult, but I was having a conversation, just to end this now, I've got to end this. I was having a conversation with somebody, and they were planning their wedding, and they were invited to a wedding. They have children. And they were told that no children were going to be invited to the wedding. They're just going to make it child-free. And they were really fucked off by it. And I said, well, I think you just got to respect the people who are sorting the wedding out. And plus, how amazing is that going to be? You're going to have a free, child-free night. It's going to be amazing.
Yeah.
But they didn't like it. So the question is, children at a wedding or not?
Oh, man. Do you know what? Can you say, daytime, yes, nighttime, no?
I mean, I'm a big believer in that. If they can come and take them away, and the grown-ups, can party from 5 o'clock in the evening, absolutely fine.
That's what I'm talking about. I went to a wedding just like that in January. Although we didn't take our kids, but anyway, but that's what the relatives did, and that was a big success, I think. Kids in the day, adults at night.
And what a perfect place to end it. Liz White, you're an absolute treasure. thank you so much for spending your Monday night with me.
Oh, don't be daft. Thanks so much, Craig. It's lovely to
talk
to you.
Take care, mate. Speak to you soon. Thank you. Bye.
Ciao for now.
And another episode is done. What an absolute joy. I love spending time with Liz, and I hope you did too. So onwards and upwards. Next week, there is no episode. Why, Craig? Why are you doing that to us? Well, I'm going on holiday. I'm very excited. I'm having my first holiday of the year, and it's towards the end of the year. So we'll be off next week. We will be back before Christmas with some episodes, so keep this frequency clear. And until then, I've been Craig Parkinson. He's been Producer Griff, and this has been the Two Shot Podcast. You take care. We'll see you in a bit. The Two Shot Podcast was presented by me, Craig Parkinson. Recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. The remix of our theme tune is by Stolen Valor. Cheers.